Well, good evening and welcome to this live stream event on the 30th of August 2022. Martin Northrum, Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on this evening and thanks for spending some of your Tuesday evening with us. I think it'll be an interesting show tonight, a lot to talk about, and we're going to touch on a bunch of things, including what, bonds and shares and a few other things too, maybe even commodities. Before I do that, let me just remind you, as I always do, that we don't provide specific financial or legal advice in these shows. This is the general conversation only. The chat room is moderated, so just bear that in mind. But I do encourage you to share your views and opinions. This is as of the 30th of August, 2022. Use out the world to get my attention. And specifically, if you have a question, then it comes into my queue. And I've enabled Super Chat, which means that you can get your question to the top of the list if you want, or indeed make a contribution to what we do around here, which is always greatly appreciated. And just before I bring Damien, I'll just tell you that there's a poll, if you look in the chat, asking about your opinion as to where the stock market, the ASX 200, will be in a year's time. Higher, lower, the same, or impossible to tell. Be interested to see what you think. And at the end of the show, I will reveal all. Anyhow, with that all done, let me push this button and bring Damien in. Damien, hello.
Martin, good to see you.
Hello. Can you believe another month has gone by already? I want a recount.
Yes, I know. It seems to, they seem to be getting, well, actually, no, I must admit, we're still, while it has been fast, it hasn't been, I feel as if the couple of months earlier on in the year were catastrophically, like everything was changing dramatically, whereas I feel as if, the latest month, you know, I think last time we were talking about this bear market rally and discussions about whether it's real or not, and sort of feel as if the discussions haven't really changed a lot. There's just there's a lot of new facts coming out, but there's still a question about, you know, are we in this bear market rally or not? And so that's where we find ourselves today.
It is the fundamental question because, of course, that is connected to future economic activity, therefore future values of stocks, because if, in fact, future values of stocks are driven on future revenue, when revenue is coming down, that's going to mean that values are probably overstated. Whereas, in fact, if the valuations are still sustainable, then, you know, they might not be so bad. But it's interesting, of course, because old Jerome Powell spilled the beans a bit at Jackson Hole, didn't he?
Yeah, he upset a few equity investors. Look, I think there's, there's this issue with it, you know, what they've just termed as the Fed put for years, and the idea behind that, for, you know, a put is an option that lets you sort of insures against losses if stock markets go down. And what they mean by the Fed put is that every time stock markets start to wobble, in the past, the Fed stepped in with lower interest rates and more quantitative easing and things like that. And what effectively is being said now is we're not coming with a Fed put because inflation is so high and we're going to get it on top of inflation. And one of the first things Jerome Powell did when he sort of hit started warming the seat at the Fed a few years ago was come in and say, it's not my job to bail out stock markets. And then the stock market promptly crashed pretty soon afterwards. And then they did bail out the stock markets. And so everyone went, well, you say your job isn't to bail out stock markets, but then when push comes to shove, you do. And the question now is, he's again talking the talk about saying his job is not his, and he's I think genuinely come out in a few places with sort of, I guess almost styling himself as a bit of a Volcker type figure, you know, here to solve inflation for the world and to be in central banker terms, to be, you know, right off into the sunset, a hero forevermore. And so and the equity market though keeps sort of oscillating between, no, he'll bail us out if everything looks bad, but you know, he hasn't sort of succumbed so far, and his speech was on the Jackson Hole was pretty much saying he's not going to succumb.
It's interesting. It was a really short speech, right? About eight minutes. Normally they're a lot longer. It was like, I've got one message I want to leave with you, but also Andrew Bailey from the UK and ECB and even from Japan. All of the central bankers basically had the same story. And in fact, one of the ECB representatives said, we have to actually get people to believe that we are going to do this because otherwise we have no credibility, which I thought was quite interesting.
Yeah. It's almost, I guess in a way I sort of we've been characterizing it, is there a bit of a free rider for a country like Australia where, as long as every other country or as long as some of the major ones, there's belief that they'll crack onto inflation, is that, does that give you a little bit of scope to run your economy a little bit hotter? Because most of, say, for in a globalized world, it does really matter about all the different countries and who's if we start to see a lot of, say, inflation exported from China, which is with their falling yuan is one unit. Sorry, a lot of deflation export from China, which falling yuan is clearly possible. Yep. Is that it is an integrated? It's much more integrated in terms of and what it used to be. And so, global central banks do need to be working in concert. I suppose is that message.
But it is interesting because although central banks are working in concert, China's central bank is heading somewhere different.
Yeah, and for very good reasons. I mean, there's property market there is. We've been, I think you and I have obviously been on that case for years. The property market is showing some pretty severe signs of the downturn. And I guess the real question for the property market in China is whether what we're going to see, what we've already seen, has dented confidence enough to actually sort of bring that down. Because I think there's a part where really China is relying upon people still wanting to invest in property. And if property, if you've had enough developers fall over, enough people, not paying mortgages because their property still hasn't been built, and all these other, all these empty apartments everywhere, and prices falling, if you start getting people doubting the fact that they can invest in property in China, then that their model is so pro-cyclical that could all come unraveled quite quickly. And even though just China's got a whole bunch more tools that nobody else does, it's going to be very, very difficult to try and arrest that fall.
Mm. Yeah, well, we might come back to property in China in more detail a little bit, Damien. There was this question, which I'm just going to put up because it's probably quite a good stake in the ground. This is from Daryl. He said, I want to know whether I should stay in the nuclear superannuation fund, which is down, or cash it in and go to... go to interest rates where I can get a safe 3.5%. Now, that's, of course, a lot of people are probably scratching their heads at the moment about how to deal with all of this uncertainty and the dynamics, because markets are down. There's interest in cash is a bit higher. How do you think about that?
Yeah, sure. And I guess that's, one of the key things for people to think about is how confident they are that the scenario they think is likely will occur. Because there's one thing to say, okay, I'm going to swing myself into 100% equities when I think things are good, and then I'm going to switch back to 100% cash when I think things are bad, and I'm going to time that all right, and I'm going to make a fortune out of that. And the issue is that the world is uncertain. Russia will attack Ukraine. There'll be there'll be earthquakes and a whole bunch of nuclear reactors in Japan will get flooded. There'll planes crash into towers and things like that. That things will happen that you don't expect, pandemics. And so the question is how far you want to tilt yourself. Now, we tend to try and tilt ourselves a reasonable way, but we're certainly not all in or all out. So I think we obviously went very negative at the start of the year. We're sort of carrying about 30% less equities than what we would ordinarily carry. So ordinarily, this is in our highest growth funds. We'd ordinarily carry about 85% equities. We've been carrying somewhere between 50 and 55% for the last sort of 6 months or so. And to us, that's a pretty big bet. But you are still invested in some way. And it is still a matter of saying, well, if you're wrong and things carry in a different direction or something happens, you still have these exposures to these markets. Now, we're on the more aggressive side of it. You can get sort of some people who do, and it tends to be, let's say, a stockbroker or someone like that who's going to be, or a hedge fund who might be trading you all in or all out. Most retail superannuation funds, so all the ones you hear about, all the industry funds, tend to go, well, if we're investing for 85% equities, that's what we have. And it might get to 87 or it might get down to 83, but in the end, we're investing in equities. That's and they won't try and sort of try and lean into the cycles at all. And so it's a question about what you want to do from your investment. Do you want to be with a super fund where if the market's down 20%, they're going to be down 20%? Do you want to be an investment in a fund where they're going to try and time it and go, well, if the market's down 20%, I want to be zero. And when the market's up 20%, I want to be up 20% and run the risk that they get it wrong. And you know that they're all invested on the day it goes down, or they're not invested on the day it goes up. Or do you want to try and sort of manage a sort of what I'm trying to do is manage a more a central path where you lean into it when you think the cycle's a bit high, and you lean back when you think you're sort of closer and you've got more buying opportunities. But yeah, no, look, it's a very real question. So right now for people, this question of 3.5% in bonds looks pretty good. We've certainly been buying more bonds in our portfolios. If things go the way we're expecting, earnings to keep falling. We're expecting that the bite from higher energy prices is really going to hit, plus the bite from higher interest rates. That's going to crash our earnings and demand, and so you'll see stocks fall back, bonds rise, and then we'll be switching from bonds back into stocks. But for us as an investor, for our growth investors, it's about saying, well, we're 30-35% underweight equities. That's a long way, you know, from what people have told us they're looking for over the cycle, and sort of moving back in. So whereas I think there are certainly people who are more confident of their ability to time it and want to be all in or all out. I think the danger is, if you think you're confident, you're going to be able to time it, it's quite likely you're overconfident, because there are hundreds and thousands of people out there who are all trying to do this and have been trying to do it since the start of time, and will just often get wrong-footed, and things will happen you just don't expect.
I make the point, Damien, that even today there are still some people saying, no, the Fed is going to flip. They are going to pivot, right? They're going to have to pivot. And they might. And that's really the point, right? And there are others saying, oh, I'm now pretty confident they're not going to. And that bipolar view highlights the dilemma, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And so do you go, and that's exactly where we sit. Do we go all in on our view? No, because we're pretty confident, but there's always some doubt. I guess the most confident we were was sort of pre-pandemic, where we'd seen all the numbers that coming through and we couldn't work out what the stock market was seeing, and so at that point we sort of reduced from 80% equities down to our minimums, which was sort of 25% equities. But that was where pandemic's happening. We can see it happening in other countries. We can see the expansion, and just went, this thing's going to hit, which is different to the ordinary scenarios like where we are today, which is, look, maybe the Fed will flip tomorrow. Maybe Powell will suddenly say, you know what, stock markets have fallen far enough, guys. Here's a whole bunch more money. We'll switch to turn the taps back on. I don't think so, but you need to recognize the possibility, or there may be other events that happen that cause him to do that. So it could be that, massive terrorist attack, a war, China invades Taiwan. There could be more supply chain, some dramatic supply chain issues, pandemics, whatever it is. There could be other things that can affect that can cause them to flip quite quickly.
And one of the things I think we should watch for is whether they actually redefine their inflation target. There was a lot of discussion at Jackson Hole about whether, in fact, the 2% or 2-3% is relevant, or is it actually artificially low? And a number of people there are arguing, no, you should actually have a higher inflation target, which would then give them more latitude.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I personally would prefer to see a slightly higher inflation target. I think there's an element. I mean, I guess I like to think of inflation and everyone's got their own definitions of it, but I like to think of it as a little bit of the lubricant that sort of helps economies, the engines of economies turn, in that having that bit of inflation makes it easier for some older industries to die, newer industries to sort of expand much more quickly and pay higher wages. And I think having higher interest rates in general, higher inflation and higher interest rates, I think gets you away from financial speculation. So I think if you're too concerned about keeping inflation really low, and then you end up with this bit where your actual nominal interest rates end up lower because you've got, say, 1.5% inflation and 1.5% on top of that to give you sort of like a 3% yield, then you've got these low interest rates that are encouraging financial speculation and just other things that you don't sort of want in economies. Whereas if you say had a 2.5% interest rate and a 1.5 on top of that again, sort of gives you a 4% sort of longer term interest rate, then I think that's more conducive to an economy that adjusts better to circumstances and doesn't see as much speculation.
Absolutely, and things change as well. You know, the fact of the matter is nobody quite knows. Nobody's got a crystal ball, so everyone's sort of sitting in an environment. And the number of variables that you're trying to actually juggle at the moment, I don't think I've ever known a time when there are so many variables.
Yeah, and inflation is different for everyone as well. Yeah. That's the other thing to remember is, you know, if I'm buying a new car in the last, you know, 2 or 3 years, then inflation was like, wow, this, you know, inflation's shooting higher. Whereas if you're buying a car, you know, 5 to 10 years before that, for the most part, they're falling in price. And so, you know, similar with sort of whatever it is, you want to buy a new computer anytime over the last, excluding the last 2 or 3 years with the pandemic, you're just seeing falling prices, and then all of a sudden pandemic hits and you know, problems getting chips and all that sort of stuff. So, and that's very different for people living at certain levels of wealth and you see sort of, you know, big differences in all that. So, you know, I think that's where I think you often see there's a lot of people who talk about inflation as being, you know, real inflation is much, much higher than reported inflation. And, you know, sometimes there's an element of that, but I think also there's the part where people, it's you remember when you see prices rise, but you don't remember when you see prices fall. And what we've seen, you know, over the last few years is a lot of the longer term items falling, and a lot of the infrequent purchases falling a lot. And so, I did a few charts on wants versus needs, which sort of still shows up. I haven't got one handy, but you know that the types of things you need have been increasing more in price than the types of things you want. So, for example, you know, vegetables versus ice cream. So ice cream's been, the prices there have been falling faster than your vegetables, or you know, you get your computers and all that type of stuff, and they're falling faster than something like healthcare that you need.
Though iceberg, I actually saw an iceberg lettuce for a dollar the other day, which I nearly fell over.
Right. Yes. Yeah. Well, and look, I mean, that's a classic example, though, isn't it? It's a great line. I think I can't remember which way came up with it, but you know, with avocado prices so low, you know, everyone should be able to afford a house now. Can't complain anymore. So
exactly right.
It's you know, things, weather events will push these up and down, and people, that's always been happening. And so, you know, we had hurricanes a few years ago and price of bananas just so high, and then all of a sudden everyone wants to grow bananas. And same today, you know, everyone wants to buy and grow iceberg lettuce if you can sell it for $9.
You can argue perhaps the same for oil and gas and what have you, right? But it's just a longer cycle to actually bring it on stream.
Yeah, exactly. And there's some big issues there in terms of the speed. Mm. Luckily, shale in the US is quite fast, but it's still a much longer time frame than growing a more iceberg lettuce.
Absolutely right. Now, we should just say Tony Lancantro popped in. He's probably gone now, but Tony's on in a few weeks' time, so watch out for that. But this was an interesting question from Ray, which is about the nature of inflation. If inflation is the feedback of excess money, why does the Fed need to alter interest rates to reduce demand? And it goes to the heart of what created the inflation in the first place, right? Because that's a really important question to understand. Was it the Fed printing too much money? Was it supply chain disruption? Was it effectively the you know, the gas problem and the invasion of Ukraine? Or all the above? How do those things fit
together? And governments, fiscal spending as well.
Yeah, good. I was going to say, the other one, of course, is all that government money, all that, you know, billions and billions thrown into everybody through COVID.
Yeah. Now, look, it's when you get some central bankers occasionally they drop the veil and explain that they really don't understand inflation very much. And there's some there's some papers out there that don't get a lot of credence because we're paying all these people all this money to manage our economy for us. But the net effect is that they are confused about the nature of inflation. So I don't think too many people would argue though that inflation is a problem with a mismatch between demand and supply. And now it's a question of, well, how much of it is too much demand and how much of it is too little supply when you've got inflation booming. And I think when you're seeing debt levels increase and you're seeing quite broad-based inflation moving up, then that's a typical, debt boom that we've seen over the last sort of 10, 20 years. And central banks raise rates a little bit and the growth in debt slows down and demand falls back and inflation falls back. And then if it gets too low, then they turn around and go the other way and put the interest rates up. So, lower interest rates in order to get more people borrowing and demand back up again. Now, that's a sort of typical cycle we've seen over the last 20 odd years. The problem with this cycle is, first, we had a lot of government spending that isn't typical. Secondly, we've had this other part, which is a lot of government spending. And then what we've seen is we've seen the supply chain issues come through. And then on top of the supply chain issues, just as the supply chain issues were starting to resolve themselves, we all of a sudden saw this, Russia invade Ukraine, and actually even before that. There was things going on with gas prices that prior to Russia invading that were sort of pushing prices up. And so, there's this sort of the lead of questions of how much of it is Ukraine, how much of it's the supply chain, how much of it is government spending, and how much is central banks. I sort of look upon all these as being, they're all ingredients. I think central banks have less impact than what they think they do. And we've seen from all the quantitative easing they've been doing for the last decade, basically since the financial crisis, so we're almost 15 years now of quantitative easing, really hasn't pushed inflation up. So I put that one as quite low as a factor. Other people will say, oh, well, it just, it was always going to happen. It just took whatever it was, a dozen years before it kicked in and now it's finally here. Maybe they're right. That doesn't seem likely to me. To me, it's more about the fiscal spending that we saw, the supply chain disruptions, and now the energy prices that we're seeing come through. And so the fiscal stuff's gone away. So there was all these cash splashes and job keepers and all this stuff that got spent. That's no longer happening. It's actually going the other direction. Governments are generally pulling back on the spending. The supply chain issues, I do think made a massive difference to it, and they're starting to dissipate. And as they're dissipating, the energy side though is sort of picking up. So I think the profile of the inflation has changed, but I do think there's some inherent deflationary risks that are out there. And if we continue to see what's happening in China keep on going, especially with regard to the yuan falling and demand issues there, is that China's going to start exporting a lot of deflation to people pretty quickly if things don't change.
Yeah. And all of those interactions, all of those forces and interactions are all sort of tied up together, right? So trying to unpick them is always difficult. One of the complications that I see is that we've got the Fed and other central banks pulling the interest rate lever at the same time as they're doing quantitative tightening, at the same time as fiscal spending is tightening in terms of support to households and businesses. So all of those things are working at the same time. Mm. The risk that I see is they overshoot simply because all the rugs are being pulled out at the same time, in my view.
And it takes, and they've all got delays.
Yeah, I was going to say the lag is 6 to 12 months before you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the danger, is that you, it's all a forecast, and sometimes they get lucky and things come out good because they did go too far, but then they had another offsetting effect happen 3 months later, and they can say, oh yeah, everything was fine. But yeah, you're exactly the point I guess we've been making is that so much has come out so quickly, you've got to worry about the consequences. And there are times where, you know, when I say things get lucky, you know, maybe there's a technological breakthrough and or all of a sudden energy, you know, you get like a shale boom in the US and all of a sudden the energy prices crash and you get all these things that happen that can make decisions central banks made seem like the right ones, even though they may or may not have been. And I guess that's my danger at the moment is for people who are saying, I told you that, you know, this inflation, they've been saying, you know, since the financial crisis, inflation is going to break out. It's almost here. You know, the world's going to end in this huge inflationary spiral. And they're like, I told you, you know, it was a decade late. And like, but you didn't say Russia was going to invade Ukraine and oil prices were going to go up 10 times. And you didn't say we're going to have these supply chain issues that you know, decimated shipping and sent transport costs up, you know, 1,000%. So it's a question about, you know, is the reason the sort of reason you came out with beforehand, is that then sort of shown to be the right reason afterwards that actually caused it? You know, because I guess it's that, you know, anyone can, you know, can post justify things that happen afterwards.
Yeah, that's right. You make up a story afterwards to try and explain why you did what you did at the time you did it, right? And that's often what people are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I've seen, look, we've been talking commodities for the past year about saying, look, you know, a lot of people talk about it, commodities saving you from inflation, and you know, oil, the iron ore price is now under $100. You know, the copper price has fallen quite significantly, and the people that are telling you commodities are the only things that are going to save you from inflation are often turning around and saying, oh, look, you know, I told you, see how the oil price is up and see how the gas price is up. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's not a that's not the same inflation you're asking to save us from. You know, you're saving us from this supply chain inflation and all this stuff like that. You weren't saying, oh, you got to buy these in case Russia invades Ukraine and you know, we have an energy crisis. So, I think there's certainly elements in terms of that I think are worth, it's worth looking back upon, you know, the question about beforehand, what I think is going to happen before and then what's going to happen afterwards is and what did happen and then, you know, being prepared to say, look, you know, times we got it wrong. We think we got it, you know, we think they had the overall reason right, but the question is about whether you automatically assume that if, you know, I said something was going to happen beforehand and then that thing did happen. Was it for the reasons I said, or was it just actually every now and again you just get lucky?
Mr. Lowe said no interest rate rises until 2024, right? November last year, things changed. And he's sort of trying to post-justify the reason why that's changed. And, of course, then saying, well, of course, we made certain assumptions. Those assumptions were different than from what happened. And therefore, our opinion. Now, it's easy to try and retrofit that afterwards. But a lot of people at the time would have heard him with a much greater clarity of message than perhaps he intended. I don't know.
Well, and I think as well at the time he was concerned about the downside. He was worried about people getting too bearish and he wanted people out spending the money on houses to help sort of bring the economy back up. And now my take would be, you know, what really happened was, yes, he wanted lots of people to spend more money on houses and all that type of stuff. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, now we've got too many people spending money. And right. So, and I do think there's an element in Australia as well of following, you know, this is what they're doing in the US and other central banks. Yes. And so therefore we better do something as well.
And that's a really important point because, you know, people have been saying, well, will we find the same thing here? And of course the truth is that the ASX 30 day is now up again. So it's at 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, you know, higher than previously. This is since Jackson Hole. So the rational argument is, well, the RBA is going to follow what the Fed is going to do. In other words, it's more likely we're going to see rates higher in Australia this week than what we thought last week.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's that's what the market is, how the market is interpreting it. Yes. It's interesting, yields in Australia are much higher than yields in the US. You know, I guess I'd argue that we've got an economy that's much more susceptible to higher rates and is actually going to suffer a lot more from higher rates because there's a much greater prevalence of floating mortgage rates versus fixed.
Yep.
So in the US, for anyone who's not aware, most mortgages are done on 30 years. So you lock yourself in for a mortgage, and if you're getting whatever it is, 4%, that's your rate for the next 30 years. If it falls, you can refinance. You can pay out your loan and refinance. But if it rises, you don't have to do that. You can just keep that rate. So when the US raises rates, what they're really affecting is new home buyers. Whereas Australia is different because there's so much of us, so many people have floating rates that it flows through much more quickly. Mm. Having said that, we've actually got a much greater proportion at the moment who are on fixed rates because of the 3-year, because the RBA was sort of pushing down the 3-year rates. But they will be rolling off over the next sort of, 6 months to 18 months. You'll see those roll off. And so it could actually affect Australia. We're having a bit more of a delayed reaction than what we usually would have, I suppose. But having said that, we've still got a much greater proportion.
Yeah.
And we've got a higher debt burden.
Yeah, the debt burden is the one I was going to highlight. And of course, it's a bit like the adjustable rate loans in the US, right, when they started putting rates up and then suddenly people move from this level to this level. Well, that's what's going to happen for a lot of those fixed rate loans, which were 1.99 or 2%, and they're now looking as though they'll be 4.5 to 5%. Those are huge, huge steps up.
And in terms of percentages, it's over the course of a year, it's the biggest ever in Australia's history. So it's just it's a massive, massive change. And I don't know. I guess I look upon that as if I had this debt fueled runaway economy, say that we'd had in 2006, 2007, with this mining booms going on and everyone talking about wage rises coming through and all these things like that, I'd be like, ramp up as fast as you can, get those interest rates higher and get that, solve this problem. But we haven't got that. What we've got is, wage growth almost nowhere, and supply chain and energy driven shocks coming through. And so I think we've overplayed the factors that we're facing in Australia. And noting as well that the US is seeing some signs of wage growth, some reasonable signs of wage growth. So they've got a lot more reason to actually be concerned about it. Whereas you spoke about the RBA changing their tune. One of the things they did change their tune on very much as well is they said, "Well, we're not going to worry about our forecasts anymore for wages because we keep getting them so wrong.
Yep.
So we're going to wait till we see actual wage growth." And that went out the window as well because we haven't seen actual wage growth.
No, absolutely. And, of course, consumer confidence in Australia, according to Roy Morgan today, dropped again. So we are still seeing consumer confidence at levels we only really saw, through COVID, right? If you go back to even the global financial crisis, it wasn't as low. So consumer confidence is a real issue. Now, okay, the retail was a bit stronger, the results this week, but I think that's a lag effect. I think we'll see retail turnover drop. Plus, of course, a lot of the retail turnover is higher because of inflation.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was about to say. Is there's a noticing it very much in the US now is the volume. If you look at a volume weighted measure of retail, retailers are looking quite sick. If you're looking at price related, then they look quite good because inflation's so high that they're seeing. People are still out there spending whatever it is, $1,000 on these goods. It's just they're getting a lot fewer goods than what they used to get.
Yep. And I think that's the main reason why the retail was where it was. So it doesn't actually indicate strength, right? Which is how it was reported in a lot of the mainstream media, I noticed, through the week. Now let's move the conversation on. Vanessa asked a great question earlier on, or made a statement about the dollar shortage. We're in a dollar shortage. It's important to know what's happened in 2008 that caused the global economy to falter. EU banks brought crap US assets to get loans from US banks. It's not, she went on to talk about it. But let's just talk about that a bit, because it's really important to put that in the context of what's happened with DXY, right? So this is actually the the dollar against the basket, 108.72 currently, according to this. The US dollar is so strong.
Sorry, what time frame is that over?
So this is from 2015,
right?
Up till now, yeah. So 108.72, right? Which is way high. So it's a very strong dollar. Liquidity is what I'm trying to get to here. Damien, liquidity in the US dollar. What's going on there?
Yeah, so look, it's an interesting one, this one. So I think if you're looking at the quantitative tightening, this is one of the issues about saying when central banks are flooding the market with all this extra money, then everyone's got all this excess liquidity and they're trying to look for homes for it. And the idea is that the lower end, everyone's got lots of money to spend, and so they start stepping up the risk curve. They're like, I can no longer invest in these safe things because they're all taken up. Let me go on up the risk curve and keep going, and that sort of floods money out to the market. Now we're sort of pulling things back in the other direction, and the question is always about does that start to expose some problems with plumbing in the system as there's people out there who are looking for collateral, and there's no longer as much high quality collateral out there as what it used to be, and so if I have to if I have to hold a certain amount because I'm a bank and I can no longer get that money, now I have to bid up the price elsewhere struggle or start to use other assets as that, and the argument there is that that creates then if you haven't got that collateral, then people start chasing higher quality assets like US dollars, and that then pushes the US dollar higher. And if you want to extend that sort of whole what you see in sort of these typical cycles where you start seeing the US dollar higher, is that you start to see emerging markets start to struggle at that point. And a lot of emerging markets have debt which is based in US dollars. So as the US dollar gets stronger, what happens is their debt burdens actually get a lot worse, and so you start running into emerging market problems and things like we're starting to see some in Sri Lanka is a little bit related to that type of thing. We've also got Turkey, which is sort of having a few problems, but the issue is, will that spread out to more countries around the world? And there's clearly that is a potential problem as the Feds are drawing all the liquidity out of the system, and money's sort of then starting to looking for safe assets, and so heading to US dollars. And one other thing with that, sort of a related issue, is that the other thing, so emerging markets don't generally like a rising US dollar. The other thing they don't like is when the yuan is devaluing, and because China is a competitor for a lot of them out there. And so when the yuan is devaluing, what happens is it makes the commodities they're trying to sell to China more expensive, and it also makes the goods they're trying to buy back from China cheaper, and so it means that. Or the goods they're competing with, say to sell to the US, makes Chinese goods cheaper, and so there are a number of quite concerning signs in emerging markets. That what you were talking about earlier about rate cuts in China and more concerns about that growth slowing and bond rates going the opposite direction of everyone else, that could all sort of adds together into that pot with that that issue about dollar shortage. And the US dollar being so strong can create these emerging market crises.
Absolutely.
So not guaranteed, yep. but it's certainly much higher risk than it was a few years ago.
Yeah. And I think the emerging markets, if we think we've got a problem with inflation, those emerging markets, the inflation is running so fast and hard. I mean, Sri Lanka's a classic example, right?
Yeah, and probably even separate. They're probably a bit too extreme in that some of that is self-inflicted, and issues with that.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of a microcosm of what's going to happen elsewhere in terms of, I think we've spoken about food inflation before, and I've spoken about saying, well, the issue is there's actually not a lot of, say wheat prices, there's actually not a lot of wheat price in your loaf of bread at sort of 30 cents or so, which for a developed market economy, when your price of bread, if I'm buying the nicer bread and it's $3 or $4 and it goes up by 30 cents, it doesn't really bother me. It's the emerging markets where it really hits. And so when you get a shortage of something like wheat, it doesn't really stop consumption that much in developed markets. And they can, a lot of the consumers there can just trade down and avoid that anyway. Where it usually hits is developing markets and emerging markets. They're the ones who get the real food shortages. And they're the ones where the loaf of bread was only costing whatever it is, 50 or 60 cents, And so now a 30-cent addition to that makes a big difference. And that's happening there. It's also happening in energy. So it's worth noting that Europe's got some just eye-watering levels of gas prices that they're paying in order to get enough gas through shipments from Qatar or from sort of re-diverted things from Australia and things like that to get that extra energy that they need. The issue is if there's not enough energy out there, someone is losing those. The reason why they're bidding those prices up so high is to get it away from somebody else. And usually, once again, it's an emerging market that'll lose the loser. Something like a Bangladesh, for example, will lose a cargo of gas that was going to go there, but the prices have just got so high that they can no longer afford it, and it ends up in Europe. And so, they're the countries that are more at risk of things like blackouts and stuff like that, because they're sort of, again, cop that at that end. And there was one other thing I was going to say on the emerging markets. So the energy prices, the food prices. Oh, fertilizer, that's the other one, is a lot of the problems in Sri Lanka are put down to sort of decisions about fertilizer and that what that meant is that, by not having the fertilizer, then their crop yields were so much worse, which then created all these, food price inflation and stuff like that. Is that because gas prices are so high, that's then also that gas is a key input into some fertilizer. Or some types of fertilizer, and so what that's meaning is that you've potentially got that same issue is that farmers will stop putting as much fertilizer because they can't afford the fertilizer, and then end up with lower yields and some more food inflation, which again will hit these emerging markets. So another problem that is, again, none of these are guaranteed, and it's not sort of saying that there's an emerging market crisis that's absolutely positively going to happen, but there are so many more indicators now. They're saying it's emerging markets are vulnerable compared to what there was a year ago.
Yes. And, the grain they've managed to get out of Ukraine, which is going to some of those emerging markets, is a very small proportion of what they were able to do previously. So there are huge food issues across many of those emerging markets.
And droughts. It's not not just the Ukraine. I mean, I think for my part, the world could handle not having the Ukraine, for a season or two without too much of a worry. If everything else was all right, it's the problems elsewhere. And food. I think we've spoken again before on this, saying there's some things which are vulnerable to supply disruptions, and they really that really jacks prices. Food really isn't one of them, because the world is used to having droughts in particular areas, or floods, or just bad rain weather patterns sort of wiping out the Canadian wheat for one season, and the next season it's just rain wheat, and the world adjusts, it moves around and can change what crops are being used. But if you start taking out sort of big chunks like the Ukraine, and then you get the next problem come on, or the next problem, then that's where the dangers lie. So I think there's the fertilizer issue is an upcoming one, coupled with what's happening in the Ukraine, and then the droughts that we're seeing, and potentially floods. There's areas in China that were drought stricken, and now they're about to flip around, and worry about floods. It's a bit like sort of Queensland sort of went through that, like it was in 2000. It was a big floods in Queensland. That was sort of mid 2000s, yeah. late 2000s, yeah. And so, obviously, too much rain is just as bad as too little rain for these. And so, or certainly as our iceberg lettuce was, a lot of that was too much rain. Keeping I guess in mind that more extreme weather patterns or more variable weather patterns, if through climate changes, we're likely to continue to see this.
Yes, and there are floods in areas of the Indian continent at the moment. They've got huge issues across China, as well as many other countries too. So it's a big deal, because a lot of these climatic variations are more significant, and that's just creating more pressure on the food supply. And by the way, in, for example, Europe, the costs of fertilizer have gone up so much that now farmers in the UK are saying, well, we're not going to actually buy fertilizer. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually not put so much input in terms of fertilizer, much lower yields, because we can't afford to.
Yeah, and if that's farmers in the UK who can do the maths and numbers, then you can imagine the farmers in, you know, in India or Bangladesh or places like that are struggling even further. And that's where, that's my main point is that emerging markets will get hit harder. Now, in terms of stock markets, and it's hard to sort of say this without seeming really callous. So I'll try and phrase it in the right way. Is that it's a humanitarian issue for this from a stock market issue. So much of the world market is based in developing countries that it really makes very little difference. The issue comes about if you get a broad emerging market crisis. Mm. So a crisis, isolated crisis in Sri Lanka, nobody really cares. Yep. If you get something like an Asian crisis where a whole bunch of countries, one after another, start hitting that same problems, that's where you get, that's where it can become an issue. Or we've had Latin American crises where they, you know, a lot of debt blew up that wasn't expected, and that sort of then bled out to the rest of the economy.
And of course, the IMF and other of those global entities are all forecasting now much lower growth, pretty much everywhere. Right. Mm. So we're starting to see the seeds of a sympathetic slowdown, as it were.
Yeah, right. That's right. And so I guess it's this part where we spoke about the Fed raising rates and all those types of things. So they're trying to put a handbrake on the economy, and high energy prices are already a handbrake. Like they say the best cure for high prices in commodities is high prices, because it spurs more investment and actually gets things going and stuff like that. Gets more investment, which then gets more supply and eventually brings prices back down. But what we've got is a Fed raising rates plus all these energy prices that are also dragging on the consumer budget. It's easy to see how we can beat demand down to a much lower level, and then all of a sudden see that we can't get it back up and running again when they want to flip around and suddenly start pushing again. If you beat it down too far, we've spent the last 15 years trying to get demand higher and really struggling with it.
Absolutely. Now, here's an interesting question, which will take the conversation slightly further. What are your thoughts on the energy cartel? Is this a link to the economic issues that we're having? This is from Sleeping Tiger, and thanks for the super chat, Sleeping Tiger. Big question, important question. And I guess, we've done a few shows on the energy cartel and how it impacts Australia, but of course the energy cartel is a global thing, isn't it?
Well, that's it. I was about to ask which energy cartel. So we have, we effectively have a, we know that we've got an OPEC oil energy cartel. In terms of gas, Russia is effectively a cartel into itself in Europe, and then Australia, we've got the East Coast energy cartel, where they want global prices and they want to charge Australian. So I'm assuming we're talking about the Australian cartel.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assumption. And
fair assumption.
So let's go with that, shall we?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I don't. Look, it's made a bit of a difference. I mean, and so you've obviously, Dave came on the show a few weeks ago and sort of spoke about it. I think the thing is, for me, I don't want to downplay what Dave is saying, because he's right. This is an emerging crisis, but it hasn't really emerged that far yet. And the price, the effects, So because there's a most people have a bit of a lag, so we have these wholesale prices and then they need to flow into retail prices, and that can take a while, is that ordinarily the your power bill goes up in winter, comes down in spring, goes back up again in summer, and then down again in autumn. So throughout the year it fluctuates depending upon whether you're trying to heat your house or cool your house. And in the middle, you actually get this period where your energy prices come down. Now, we're coming out of our maximum prices for energy in terms of winter and coming into a spring. And so it might be that instead of doing this sort of up and down, we sort of go up and we just don't come down, because we've got all these prices, these high prices start to hit just as usage sort of falls away. And so it might not be for another 4 or 5 months that people really notice that they're paying higher prices, until you hit your summertime peaks, and then you get another bit of a spike, and And but you know, maybe the what do you call it, the a lot of the solar power takes a little bit of the edge off that one, and it's not really until next winter that we really feel that this crisis, if nothing's been done by then. And so I guess the way I look at the energy cartel is it's creating this massive potential problem that's only really, we're just feeling the edge of it, and you know, really we're just feeling the tip of the iceberg at the moment, because if that actually comes, you know, if we don't do anything, then by next winter that's going to be causing this massive problems. But I sort of look at the issue and say, well, it might not feel like a crisis for some time, 6 months, and maybe as much as, you know, 8 or 9 months before it feels like a crisis.
Yeah, and, you know, the interesting question about that, of course, is, and what David was saying, was that we have, particularly down the East Coast, backed ourselves into a corner because we are basically exposed to the international gas prices through the LNG exports. Mm. And because our electricity is priced off gas, the true price of energy is going to go through the roof.
Yeah, that's right. And coal as well, to a certain extent.
Correct.
Yeah, because coal's a substitute for gas.
Correct. But the point that you make, and I think it's right, is that it's a bit lagged insofar that it doesn't. And there are some controls in terms of what prices can be charged when and how and those sorts of things as well, which has a bit of a...
And people have six-month contracts. And,
yeah.
You know, there's a sort of rolling period. But, so, yeah.
But I can tell you...
Sorry.
Okay. I was going to say, I can tell you in my surveys that energy... costs and the rising energy costs is now figuring as one of my top three things that people are worried about in terms of managing their budgets going forward. So they're already seeing some significant pressure.
Yeah, and they should be. But I guess to put it in numerical terms, I guess, you know, whatever, you might have peaked with your $300 for a month of power in winter, but then it usually falls back to 150 in spring, but this time it just doesn't.
Nope.
It falls back from 300 to 250 or something like that. And you're like, oh, that's much better. You know, I was paying 300, now I'm only paying 250. And so, but you're still miles up on what you should have been paying. Yep. So, yeah. So there's and it's not until you get back above that $300 that you all of a sudden go, oh, wow, that's, you know, that's really sucking off.
And it's just worth recalling the UK, you know, they've gone from effectively a sort of a price cap of around, well, let's say £1,000, just to make it simple. It's now up to sort of 5,000 to 6,000, and they're talking about more, and that's within a year.
Yeah,
that's the quantum that they're looking at. Now, I'm not going to suggest we're going to go the same way, but the trajectory is very clear because of the cartel and the fact that, as David argues, well, 97% of the profits go offshore. Most of those cartel members don't really care about the local market, they care about energy going offshore, and unless we get a reservation system or something to actually protect the local market, this is potentially one of the most significant impacts to the economy over the next 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, and some of these companies still think they're not ever going to pay tax, or never going to pay these super profits taxes, or the you know, so they're making super profits but don't have to pay any taxes on it. And so you know, ordinarily, if you had a taxation system set up to, you know, you could sort of get away with it. If we had a proper tax on this stuff, so that, yes, there's super profits being generated, the Australian government's raking this money and they can turn around and help people out with the power bills, but we're not. So if we turn around and help people out with the power bills, all we're doing is subsidising these companies to go and do, you know, take more offshore. And,
correct.
And again, it's, as you sort of said, it's our gas. It's actually not the company's gas. It's owned by the Australian government. They're allowing the companies to take it out and charging royalty for them to do it. It's not like the companies are like, no, we own this gas. Mm. It's not. It's owned by the Australian government. So, the fact when we're making, anyway, we could, I'll leave that for Dave. People can listen into Dave's article.
I was going to say, there was an earlier show. I'll put the link in the comments below after the recording's finished, and people can go and have a look at it, because we did go into a lot of detail, and a lot of people were quite surprised as just to how the thing was sort of functioning. But it's a very important conversation, I think.
Yeah, and a great example of how Australia's got this real problem with vested interests. And
Interests and political interests, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And when it's boring, like, you know, the power pricing and gas reservation and stuff like that, you can get vested interests making who are some of the largest donors there are to our political parties effectively writing, you know, this stuff and explaining what a great thing it is and how, you know, you never have to worry about that, Martin. We'll be the largest exporter in the world. Why would prices go high? We'll always have plenty of gas. You know, gas prices would never get to that level. Don't even need to put it in there.
Well, so. I'll tell you something amusing. Well, serious, but amusing. In the UK, they are now seriously starting to have a debate about whether the privatisation of the energy and water and other infrastructure services, which they did 20, 30 years ago, actually was right. Yep. There's actually a real sort of groundswell now amongst the community saying, actually, we're being, you know, messed up.
Yeah.
Messed over.
Well, I'll plug one of my own podcasts. We had a complete mental blank. Catherine, who's a, I've forgotten the surname, who was part of policy design and everything, as part of the WA market. And so I just want to remind people that Australia has effectively got three different energy markets. One is in WA, the other is in Northern Territory, and the other is the rest of Australia, which is all networked up. Now, WA isn't hooked up to it. They're trying to get WA hooked up to it, and you know, we created this national energy market, whatever it was, 20, 30 years ago. We've spent all this time and effort about competition. They keep trying to rip us off because that's what companies do, and so we need all these regulators, and they keep outsmarting the regulators, and we need to put in new rules, and we need to have all this stuff. So we've got this, we're trying to create this fake competition over in the Eastern Coast. And the net effect is we've got massive wholesale energy prices. You know, they've gone up whatever it is, 5 to 10 times higher than what they usually are. And then you look over at WA and basically prices are about what they used to be. And they've got a gas reservation system and largely driven by governments. Yep. And they don't have to try and come up with these, you know, let's come up with this way to create fake competition between retailers when, you know, who's your energy through, Martin? Are you getting it through this person or that person? It's the same electrons, it's the same power generated from the same place. It's just, you know, did yours come with an AGL, bill, or does it come with an Origin bill? You know, what's your, and so there's a genuine argument about, you know, what I'm fully on board with that. Did a whole podcast on it, it's that adage from an economist point of view is saying, look, privatization does help for a lot of things, but you should be privatizing, say, the airlines, but not the airports, because you don't want to privatize monopoly assets, because then you just get either the companies just rorting the system, or you have to create this sort of fake competition that then just costs you more in terms of policing and all that stuff and the benefit you get. So privatize the airlines because they're competing, but if you've got an airport and it's a monopoly asset, then it doesn't make as much sense to privatize that. Mm. Or if you do, you just run into all the problems we're seeing now.
Don't get me started on airports, because of course Sydney Airport, which was privatised and was doing very well, got bought out and went private. And as an ex-shareholder of Sydney Airports, I feel hard done by now.
Right. Yeah. Well, and so now it's privatised, and now you have a lobbyist in there who's paying, donating to political parties, whose whole thing is don't build a second airport.
Yep.
You know,
exactly.
We don't want you. We don't want to have cheaper air flights. We want to funnel everyone into the same thing.
Exactly.
And in Melbourne, you want to drive past a cow paddock and then pay whatever it is, $20 an hour to park next to a cow paddock. Then you're sort of saying, you know, this isn't CBD parking. So anyway.
Okay. This is one from Stripey Cat. Whoops. Pushed the wrong button there. Hang on. Let me just get this one up first. Let's get the right button. Got too many buttons going. Okay. Enjoying the chat and show. Great. What's your outlook, Damien, for interest rates and the Aussie dollar in the next 12 months?
Yeah. Okay. So the Aussie dollar, I expect to be weaker. I expect that we're going to see a commodity cycle turn. We'll continue to point lower in most commodities. The gas prices are one disclaimer to that. I do think we're into this quite weak period for economies. So in terms of interest rates, look, it, I think the longer term rates are going to fall as we start to go into as economies start to weaken over the next 6 months. Now, how long is it going to take central banks to reverse course? I don't know. Is the shorter, so on the shorter term answers, you know, are interest rates going to keep rising for another 6 or 9 months while central banks sort of, you know, while they recognize that they've done too much and too quickly, and in concert with everything else, or do they go earlier, or do we get hit by some sort of, you know, we get slapped in the ass by a rainbow and something lucky comes along and sort of bails us all out. The last one, I'm not betting on. So my bet would be that over the next sort of 6 months, as earnings really start to weaken and we start to see much more signs that the economies are slowing, I think we'll see central banks at least pause in what they're doing, and probably by the end of 6 months, and certainly by the end of 12, they'll be reversing and starting to push back the other way.
Yeah. But it does depend on what the Fed does, right?
Yeah.
Because the exchange rate is a differential rate predominantly with the US, right?
It is, yeah. So it is, but I think my preferred way to think about Australia and the Aussie dollar particularly is it's a bit of a supercharged view on the world economy. So when the world economy is going well, the Aussie dollar goes really well. And the Aussie economy does, because we've got so much resources, and we get that benefit from world economies growing quickly. When the world economy goes the other way, though, that's where the payback is, and the Aussie dollar is weaker, and the Aussie economy does worse. And so that's where, you know, my expectation is we are going into a much weaker period. There's dangers of deflation, and in that environment, that the Aussie dollar will do much worse. So not quite irrespective of interest rates, but certainly that economic growth can overpower if interest rate differentials between the two countries.
Mm. Oh, fair enough. But I suppose the other question is international debt. You know, we're very heavily debt exposed, aren't we, because of the way that we fund a lot of what goes on here over there, as it were.
Yeah.
And therefore, the cost of debt's pretty significant if rates are high in the US.
In the US. Yeah, look, we're not as exposed. We're not that exposed to US-denominated debt. We're not if you're in an emerging market country, and not to say Australia doesn't often look like an emerging a lot of emerging market countries look a lot like Australia. They're big exporters, big energy exporters or commodity exporters. But the difference is they will often have a lot of their debts denominated in US dollars, where Australia is big enough and safe enough that a lot of the lending is either swapped out or done in Aussie dollars. So it doesn't have the same sort of issues you do in an equivalent emerging market. So and keep in mind, Australia looks a lot like an emerging market from all economic perspectives. Yes. Our education levels are much higher, and you know we've got all these other added benefits. But if you look at the complexity in manufacturing and all this type of stuff like that, Australia looks like an emerging market.
And I will make the point that our 2-year 10 is not inverted, whereas the US is. Well, that tells you something quite interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, it does. I had a chart I was going to bring up on that, and I realized I think there was a data feed problem that was coming through. But yeah, the US, you sort of have that issue where the US is their bond yield curve is inverted, it's flat. So basically, if you want to borrow money at a shorter term, it's going to cost you more than longer term, which is usually the other way around.
Let's just put those up. So this is the 2-year. Okay, US 2-year at 3.4048, right?
And the Aussie is what?
And the US 10-year, if we just do the US first, is 3.058, right? So the 10-year is significantly down, right? And if we look at then the Aussie,
and to put that into context for people, is what usually happens is, if you're going to give your money to the US government for 10 years, usually you want a higher interest rate than if you're only going to give it to them for 2 years. There's a term premium.
Yeah, that's right, because you can't access it for a longer period of time, so you expect to be paid more for holding it for a longer period of time. And that's what the 2 year in Australia is 3.145, and the 10 year is 3.602. So it's a remarkably different picture, isn't it, between those two scenarios, right? And of course, the argument is that if you have an inversion of 2-10, in other words, if the long-term rates are lower, that's because people are thinking that rates will be lower because the economy will being less well, and therefore rates will be lower.
That's right. Yes, so Australia is facing that. I mean, Australian rates do tend to be higher than the US rates over time. Now, I think the main argument people give for that is that we're a capital-hungry economy, and so we need higher rates. And also, actually, our inflation targets are a little bit higher as well. So over the longer term, we need higher rates to attract the capital. That might be true. It's I find some of those arguments they're true until they're not. And then everyone changes. That comes up with a different reason. For me at the moment, it really doesn't make sense, that whole the difference between the US and Australia in terms of the longer term rates. If the US is going into recession, then that's going to hit commodities. And unless you have China running gangbusters at that time, and it does not look like China is going to save us this time around. China really saved Australia post financial crisis when they spent so much money on their building. But actually, that's worth probably a good segue into bringing up that building chart, isn't it? Property starts.
Okay. That's one of your charts, right? Hang on, let me just do a couple of licky things. Let me go there.
But basically, look, I'll
this is the China property one?
Yeah. Yep. So the numbers are in let's not worry too much about the actual units because there's a lot of zeros on the end of it, but let's call it nine, around the financial crisis, China was moving 20 to 25 million people into cities every year. They had housing starts of about 900, then lots of zeros behind it. So I think 900 billion square meters of property was what their starts were. That, the time, though, that's right back on this left-hand axis, on the left-hand side of this chart. And at the time, one of their premiers was famously quoted as talking about the Chinese economy being so unbalanced at that point in time and out of whack, and it needed to rebalance back to more consumer spending. Now, since then, it went from 900 up to, well, we recently peaked at over 2.3. There was a bit of a slowdown in 2015 that crashed the iron ore price back to sort of $30. We're sort of getting close back down to those levels. This orange line is an extrapolation based on sales. You could still fall from our current level of 1.6. You could still halve the number of property starts, and you would be back to the level where the Chinese premier was talking about how unbalanced the Chinese economy was, and it needs to have less building. There's a lot of that goes. So much steel goes into Chinese property. So much copper goes into Chinese property. Commodity. You go through all the different commodities. If it keeps going the way it's going, it will be a good thing for the Chinese economy in the long term. It's going to be very, really tough in the short term because there's just so many factors there.
And one of the things is that they are actually demolishing some of the partly finished high rise that they didn't finish building for various reasons, right? And recycling some of the steel out of those to build new ones.
Yeah, that's important because steel usage is actually recycled steel usage in China is very, very low, especially compared to any other developed or any developed economy. So most of the steel in the US gets recycled. Mm. In China, I think it's sort of 30% ish. And part of the problem was 10 years ago, you were knocking down a peasant's hut and sticking up a high-rise building. Well, there's no steel in the peasant's hut, but you need heaps of steel in the sky-rise. Yeah. And what you're saying is exactly right, is now the problem is you're starting to knock down skyscrapers to put up other skyscrapers. Sometimes they'll be using less steel. You know, you build a bigger skyscraper with the same amount of steel that you used in the other one because it just, you know, production techniques and building techniques are more efficient. And so, that's just further going to reduce the amount of sort of fresh steel needed from Australia.
And the thing that I just find remarkable is it's a way of keeping more people employed, right? So you build them, knock them down, build them up again, knock them down again, right?
Yeah. Well, and I've likened it to the Soviet sort of war machine that sort of brought down the USSR, which was, you know, they're trying to keep effectively just building all these military supplies. It was most of their economy was really just about military supplies, and eventually the whole thing came unstuck because they just couldn't afford the debt anymore for non-productive assets.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know about you, but it seems to me that building an apartment, knocking it down and building a different apartment is the very definition of a non-productive asset.
Well, I tend to agree. And, of course, a lot of them are actually half-finished before they knock them down and then build them up, so they never actually get to be lived in. So it's not a very useful asset. It's just, you know, cycling for the sake of cycling. And, of course, the other thing, just to touch on that, prices are falling as well. So the value of property is falling, as well as the volume of new starts falling. And, of course, some people are now on mortgage strikes. So they're actually not because they, believe it or not, start paying their mortgage when they sign up for one of these things that haven't been built yet.
Yeah, and that's that whole pro-cyclical part of the economy there is. So, and what I mean by this is that you've built this, you build this economy around property in particular in China where it's called pro-cyclical. So when things are going well, they start going even better and then even better and then even better. But then at some stage, the whole thing reverses. And so part of the, and the reasoning is, in Australia, you know, you want to build an apartment. I want to buy an apartment for $200,000 off the plan. I put down $10,000, and then when the apartment's finished, I shell out the rest or whatever, or $20,000. In China, it's $200,000 up front. You start paying your mortgage. You know, you've just bought this apartment for $200,000. Now, for the last 10 years, that hasn't really mattered because by the time my $200,000 apartment turned into $250,000, then $300,000, then $400,000. And so, yes, I was paying interest on it, but every year it was make me $50,000 or $100,000. I'm like, oh, who cares that I was paid, whatever in interest when I made all this extra money from it. When that starts to go in reverse, all of a sudden people don't want to put more money into the property. At the same time as you had that going on, you've got the people paying the developers up front. The developers then getting more debt on top of that. So they've already got the money to build the apartment, but they've gone and raised some more debt and paid themselves higher amounts. And then you've got local governments who are benefiting from it as well, so that they don't actually charge. In China, most of the money from that lost me for a sec.
Yeah, you come back. Back. Yep. Right, you froze.
Come back. Yeah. So most of the the tax revenue they get is from selling land, and so if they're selling land and then recycling that back into more debt, recycling that back into more building and then buying more land, then when it all stops, all of a sudden local governments don't have any money, and that's exactly where we've ended up this year as well, because we've seen that they've extended the debt. The amount of debt that the local governments can go into. They've brought forward next year's quotas into this year, so they can build more. And at face value, that sounds great. More debt in China to go and do more building. And actually, the answer is no, it's not. It's the fact that they're actually building the same amount of building that they were building last year. It's just that they've had to spend twice as much debt because they've got nothing else to fund it with. And so, it's sort of the person who's, I'm going to let you spend your credit card balance from next year as well because you lost your job. It's like, well, that might be great, but in the end, I've just got a higher debt and I still don't have a job. So, there's and a whole bunch of other factors that are all the same in China. This will make that much, much better on the way up, which we saw, but much, much worse on the way down.
And it's just worth pausing to think what proportion of China's GDP is property related because it's a huge number, isn't it?
Absolutely, probably twice the size of any other economy, and that's exactly what you saw in that chart was that growth. So could they? The thing is, you could make this argument though at any stage over the last 15 years, you could say this about China, and we have made that argument several times, many times over the past 15 years, and so for a brief moment in the sunshine in 2015, it looked like they were doing it. They were starting to rebalance. And then they slowed too quickly, and they just went, look, we'll do it later. And threw the more debt at it. In early 2019, they actually started to do a lot of these changes. So a lot of the three red lines and other policies all came in 2019. And then the pandemic hit and they reversed everything. So China knows it's a problem. They know they're spending way too much on this. I think the stat is something like, if you look at just houses under construction, one in every six households in China has a house under construction right now.
Yep.
The stats are amazing. So they know there's a problem, but they can kick the can down the road if they want.
Yeah.
They could suddenly say, you know what?
Plenty of tools.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The problem is if you've pushed it as far as you have now, so they've got their foot on the windpipe of the developers saying no more debt and you can't keep using other people's money to build the next set of apartments, is they take their foot off the throat of developers. Are developers going to rush out and get a lot more debt? I don't think so. I think they've had a near-death experience. It's going to take a while before they do. Our consumers now going to go, well, just a minute, we've uncovered all these problems with debt and with house building. Are we now as confident that the house prices only go up?
Yeah.
I don't think so. And so, they could have already pushed it too far that, that even if they want to try and reverse it, they can't. And I think my characterization is I don't think they're trying to they're not trying to reverse it in terms of the policy at the moment. They're trying to slow it. They want to try and make sure that it doesn't bring down the rest of the economy. But the danger is it could cause a bigger crisis. It's probably more likely to be a Japan type crisis. So just strung out over 10, 20 years where lots of debt. They make the good developers, whatever ones are left, by the bad developers. They create bad banks. They get local governments to come in and finish off projects to make sure that people actually get the houses they're paid for. But there's just all this debt just sort of gets shifted around and moved and then just amortized over a 10 or 20 year period. Like we saw in Japan, they did a similar thing, except they sort of made good companies, bought all the bad companies with lots of debt, and then you had stagnation for years.
Absolutely. Now, we're coming towards the end of the show, but there's a few questions we haven't got to. One of them, which was right up the top, was commodities. So, bearing in mind where we are and, the stocks are a bit wobbly and not sure about bonds, what about commodities? Is commodities a place to be looking? And he specifically asked about uranium. Is uranium a place to be looking?
Yeah, uranium's interesting. Look, when you build a nuclear power plant, the cost of the uranium is so low compared to the cost of building the nuclear power plant that it really doesn't matter. The price could go up, whatever, 5-10 times, and it doesn't really affect the overall price because the price, the big cost was actually getting in and building this thing in the first place. So to that extent, uranium's got some benefits. My issue is, I can't make the numbers work for uranium versus renewables. So renewables just look so much cheaper, so much better, so much more scalable, so much faster to roll out. You want to get more power up and running. You can just stick solar panels around the place, and tomorrow I can have a bunch of solar panels, up and running, and I can be having someone out there putting them up every day. Whereas you want to build a new power plant, new nuclear power plant, right? You've got 5, 10, 15 years of planning and all these things going on and, complaints and, all that type of stuff. It's not fast to come on, so it's not a quick solution. It's much cheaper than current prices for fossil fuels, but if you go back to the prices we were paying, last year for fossil fuels, it's more expensive, and it's much more expensive than renewables. So, I can certainly see a very strong case for you have nuclear plants you're thinking about shutting down, keep them on for much longer. I can see the case, particularly Japan's a great example. Turning on nuclear power plants that were otherwise going to mothball, and maybe we'll see that happen in Germany as well. Some of the things that have been shut down, maybe they get brought back on again, because you're not talking about huge capital costs. Can I see an argument for or an economic argument for building starting a nuclear power plant today that realistically isn't going to be up and running for 10, maybe 15 years at the prices that you're going to pay today compared to the prices you're seeing in renewables? I just can't see anyone who can make that argument. There is an argument for stability or for diversifying your sources of energy and all these other things, like that might add up, but there's no economic argument that I can see that adds up for it. So that's a sort of a long-winded way of saying the long-term price of uranium, I can't see as being particularly strong. I mean, it's not particularly expensive to mine or difficult to find. There's certainly controls over it, and everyone hates having uranium mines near them. But you know, they can mine it at current levels and make a reasonable profits. At current levels you can mine it and make great profits. Could you see spikes in the uranium price? Absolutely. Do I think the long term price will fall back eventually? Yes, I do. How long are those spikes going to last? Can you time it? I mean, you've already missed a big chunk of the upside. So, you know, do you think you can get it all? Yeah, so that's where I guess uranium might be. Have I spoken about lithium? Did I speak about lithium last time? I think
I did. Yeah, you did.
Yeah.
And
I guess for anyone who wasn't listening, the way I look at some commodities is you look at how much it costs to produce them and are they relatively abundant? And then you go into the shorter term demand things. And so you can come up and go, well, when the price is close to the cost that it is to dig it out of the ground, you know, I can look at those prices and go, that's probably a price I'd be willing to buy at if I like the longer term outlook for it. At the other end of the spectrum, when I'm looking at it and it's 2, 3, 4, you know, 10 times higher than the cost to build a new mine and dig it out, that's where I'm saying, well, it might go from being 4 times higher than this cost to 8 times or 12 times, but I know that's only going to be a short-term price spike. And so if you want to try and trade it, great. But, if it's 4 times above the cost that it is to dig it out of the ground, I'm not, you know, that's something that's only going to last for a short period of time and I'm not buying that, sticking it in the bottom of the drawer and forgetting about it.
Very good. Now, question from Cookie Boy. Can you discuss Canadian and New Zealand property market? Well, we're not going to do a detailed trip, but we can say down is the short answer because they're going through the same cycle as we are, with interest rates rising. The Canadian Bank and the New Zealand Central Banks have both put rates up significantly higher than what we have, and they started earlier. And we're already seeing property prices dropping quite considerably in both areas. Yet both of them are talking about rates going even higher to contain inflation.
I'll leave it at that, Martin. I think I'm not an expert in either of those markets. I mean, I keep an eye on what's going on, but yep. I would profess to be an expert in either. Yep. Well, I did want to talk analyst forecasts, though, as well.
Good. That's good. Well, let's go there. Yep.
Mm. So I've got one of my favorite charts I want to show people. So this is forward estimates I've used the S&P 500 because it's pretty much a global index. And we can see on this, there's this line where, this is revenue forecasts. And so basically, and each line is a particular year. So if I pick, say, 2015, purple line in the middle, it sort of starts in the middle of that at sort of 5% growth and then goes along for a while and then all of a sudden drops away. So we can see 2022 numbers sort of shot up to 12% growth. So that was sort of based on, a lot of that is inflation driven.
Just so I'm clear. So these are the annual expected growth forecasts for revenue from the S&P 500 firms. Is that right?
Yes, yeah. Over time.
Yeah,
so,
over time, yep.
Yeah, so at the start of, let's say this 2022. So in 2020, people were expecting 2022 growth would be 7%. Mm. And then that sort of stayed there. And then eventually it shot up as we got closer. And we can see that 2023 is rolling over. So yep. We're down to sort of 3% growth now. The one that you care about, and sorry, keep in mind that's 3% sales growth with, I think most are probably assuming inflation of 5% ish or 6% ish. So it's quite negative in terms of real terms. If you look at the next one, now this one's the actual operating earnings. So that was sales, which I just wanted to highlight, has rolled over, and sales doesn't often roll over. My take for how analysts look at this is that 10% is where it starts almost every year, and then the numbers sort of stay around 10% until it gets close, and then they go one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of see that, until 2014, 13, 14, 15, 16, started at 10%, then it rolled over, eventually ended up close to zero for 15 and 16. 2018, we went the other way. That was because of the tax cuts. So, expected 10% growth, got some tax cuts, turned it into 25% growth. Then we're back 2019, back to this same expecting 10% and falling away. So basically every year from 2012, you sort of started at 10% and then ended up somewhere, say, somewhere between 0 and 5% after that. 2020 is a special case, big losses. 2021 is a special case as well because they basically go, the losses are reversing. And then we're back to 2022, which is going to come in pretty close to 10%, but 2023 is already falling away. If we look at the sectors where that's falling, that's where you can start to see, the favorite one for me to look at is consumer discretionary. And this is a different chart. So the blue line is a rolling 12-month forward. So what I'm looking at is always looking 12-month forward. So it's like a mixture of, at the moment, it's you've got three and a bit months of 2022, and then you've got 9 months of 2023. And so then in a day, you get one more day, and that keeps sort of rolling forward. So you can see the consumer discretionary starts falling pretty much before you hit recessions. So the blue lines in this chart are recessions. So 1990 started falling probably a little bit before, but certainly as the recession was starting. In 2000, it started falling before the recession started. In 2008, it started falling as the recession was starting. 2020, we saw the same thing. Now we've got quite a decent fall in so far.
Just a question on that. Definition of recession using the US definition of recession.
National Bureau of Economic Research.
They declare it retrospectively, don't they?
They do. So we could already be, you're right, we could already be in a recession. This could be, So that's sort of saying, okay, the signs are there that we're headed for, certainly in the US is headed for a recession. Mm. Now, not to say, now this isn't infallible. Sometimes you do get some downturns without recession. So, but it's a reasonable sign. The more interesting one for me is consumer staples. So ordinarily, and so what this is like your supermarkets and that type of thing. So consumer discretionary is the goods you want to buy. Consumer staples are the things you need to buy. Ordinarily, they're actually pretty good through recessions. Often they rise into recessions and don't fall until after. So in the 1990s, it just rose straight. Earnings kept on rising throughout it. In the 2000s, they flattened but never actually really fell. In 2008, it rose all the way through until right at the end where it had a fall. We're actually seeing earnings starting to roll over in the consumer staples, which is not typical. Yeah. So potentially there's other stuff going on there, but I think the main thing for me is that, look, these guys are starting to get squeezed. For a while there, they managed to put up their prices, but now people are starting to cut back on what they're buying, and so that's starting to squeeze. If you get a recession where consumer staples is falling as well, then you need to be, I guess, aware of that in terms of what stocks you're buying within your portfolio. But also, it could be a sign that it's headed for a worse recession than one where consumer staples is holding up.
Mm. And that's really important to understand because, of course, I said at the start, there's a big debate about, where are we in the cycle, right? Are we going to actually see, rates rise even more because they're talking about putting rates up even more into a recession? Yeah, right? That's one side. Or is it actually that effectively everything's going to be fine and they'll turn turtle and take rates down again, right? So,
yeah.
And I want to underscore again, this lag problem, the lag problem is real, right? Because they're pulling these levers every month at the moment, but it takes a long time for that all to percolate through, like this data that you've just shown us. It takes time.
Yeah. Oh, and look, the other thing is analyst forecasts are usually, when you hit recessions, they're usually pretty bad at getting it right.
Yeah.
It's lagged. And the reason why is because analyst forecasts really for the first year, this is whatever the companies are telling them.
Yes.
And so the companies go, you know, they go, okay, we need a forecast for this. Yep. Go and ask all the salespeople how much they think they're going to sell next quarter. Yeah, okay, everyone says they think they're going to sell 10% more than last year. That's what our forecast is. And when you're adding it up that way and you are hitting these points where you hit points of inflection, companies just aren't good at that, at recognizing that until it's still too late.
And interestingly, a lot of firms are not disclosing forward outlooks for next year through their results season, which tells you something quite important.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't know.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was, you know, during the obviously during the pandemic, that was something as well where everyone just, they all stepped back and said, and what you tend to see when that happens, and the pandemic again is a great example of that, is the companies all go, my God, lockdowns, you know, looks terrible. My earnings look like they could be down 80 or 90%. I don't know, but surely these lockdowns can't last forever. I don't know when they're going to start. So I'll say nothing. And so what analyst forecasts tend to do in that case is nothing. They'll do like a little bit of a downgrade. They'll go, okay, things look pretty bad, but company's not telling me what's going on. You know, I thought they were going to earn 10 cents. Maybe I'll turn that into 9.5 cents and see. And then, you know, 3 months later, the company finally comes out and goes, oh, okay, we're going 2 cents. And they're like, oh, okay, well, you know, I've given them a small downgrade. Now I need to chase the numbers down.
Yes.
And so I guess what I'm not saying this is like this broad criticism of, you know, nobody gets anything right and, you know, you can't trust anyone. But I guess what it is it's a criticism of recognizing that everything is a, these are human beings who are creating these and human beings react in a certain way. And when you get uncertainty, they tend to do nothing and go, well, I'm not quite sure. I'll leave things as they are until I get more certainty and then I'll make a, I'd prefer to do that. I'd prefer to be wrong for a little while until I get more certainty and then make a sudden change. And that's what you see in analyst forecasts at turning points. And so not to necessarily say we're at a turning point, but if I'm right, we are, then all the signs so far are pointing, you know, towards that. But, you know, some of these signs might be wrong. I guess I'm looking at signs and saying this is, you know, I'm extrapolating my view from these. But we need to recognise that, you know, other things are at play, and you know, we could get them wrong, and there's titanic forces clashing, and so
and we'll just remind everybody how accurate the RBA has been with its wage price forecasts. Another example of trying to make a forecast and not necessarily landing it very well, right?
No, exactly. That's and that's so that was from a few years ago, but you know, there's yeah, so what was the latest? What was it, 2.6? We're 2.7. 2.7 for wage growth.
Yep. In theory.
And we're raising rates. Mm. Yeah. And actually that wage growth as well. That was the other thing. So where am I most likely to be wrong? Okay. So if I'm wrong on inflation, where do I think it's gonna be? It's gonna be in wage growth. So we do have reasonable wage growth in the US. It does seem to be mainly at the lower end. And I guess for me, I look at the that's the US. In Australia, we're really not seeing much in the way of wage growth. Wage growth is very weak. On a real basis, it's terrible. But even on a nominal basis, you know, it's really not particularly high. So if I'm wrong, it's that wage growth will be stronger than what I'm expecting. And that wage growth will then filter into inflation and get everything ticking along. Yep. So that's where I'm trying to work out, you know, am I wrong? That's the most likely place it's going to be. In the short term, energy prices are going to hide it. So if inflation's, I think inflation now is going to be higher than, so if you had asked me, you know, 3 months ago, how long before inflation starts to fade, I would have given you a different answer than today, because I think the energy prices are going to keep that inflation higher for a bit longer. But I do still think the elements that I'm expecting to start fading away, all the goods, transport costs, excluding fuel, all these other things that were causing problems with supply chains, that's going to be fading away. And I do think we're going to see deflation exported from China. And so the core numbers are going to, if you start excluding food and energy, I think you're going to start seeing some really sharp declines in inflation over the next few months.
Absolutely. And I guess, as we draw this to a conclusion, it seems to me that the level of uncertainty is pretty high. I think the leading indicators about where interest rates are going and where wages are going are the two critical things to watch both here and overseas. But of course, there are a lot of sleeping issues with what's happening with China and, of course, the gas supply and energy and those things too. So pretty complex at the moment. Pretty complex.
Yeah. And it's worth noting as well that, you spoke about leading indicators, and there's lots of leading indicators on company earnings that are basically saying the same thing as what I'm saying. It looks like there's this big downturn coming from all the future sales and all those things. Inflation is unemployment are our two pretty much most lagged indicators that we have. They'll usually start cutting some of their advertising spending. They'll cut back on company spending, corporate cards and company spending and stuff like that. Then they'll start knocking off some hours for people. Then they'll start finally laying people off. And so there's this process they go through. So the unemployment is quite far down that process. And inflation is very similar. The inflation is lagged. These stats that come out, is a culmination of forces that are forcing, suppliers. The first month supply costs go up. A lot of retailers will just grin and bear it. And then the next month it's still high, and then the next month it's still high, and eventually they go, I've just got to pass these costs on. Though if you're watching inflation, you're watching unemployment, and you're trying to say, well, when those things turn, that's when I'm going to know and I'm going to change my investment strategy, you'll be too late. They're and if you're trying to run a central bank following those things, you'll be too late. They're our most, some of our most lagging indicators. You really want to be trying to get at the other end. And the problem with indicators at the other end is they're like your surveys, Martin, is that they're surveys and they're very helpful in terms of getting directional and everything like that. But sometimes the scale can be, yes, things are going bad, but I just don't know whether they're going to be really bad or just a little bit bad.
Yeah. It's direction rather than actually destination. Yeah.
So you've got a much faster view about it and a much, much better indication of what's going on in the real world. But you don't have that same benefit of scale and full effect that you get from some of those lagging indicators. And so, you really do need to be setting your expectations about what you're thinking for those lagging indicators, but using the leading indicators to try and work out, that's your part to say, am I right or am I wrong? And where am I looking? Yeah.
We're going to get monthly inflation, aren't we? Well, sort of, 70%-ish,
But
still say, don't rely on it, rely on the three-month lagged, right?
Yeah, I know. But look at every other country in the world. Not every other country. Almost every other developed country in the world has monthly inflation. So, at least we're
slowly getting there.
Damon,
I really appreciate your time today. Very useful conversations. Always didn't get to all the questions. We never do. But we should say that if you want to find out more about Nucleus Wealth and what the world funds, there's links and things below and a lot of information about there. And I would just make the point that when markets are moving down so significantly, and as you said at the start, it may well be that it's about the relative movement down rather than the absolute movement, which is critical, right?
Because that's right. Yeah. And question about how do you want to be invested through the cycle? Are you going to try and jump out and jump back in again and time it right? Or are you going to tilt your way into it? Or are you just going to step back and go, can't time it. I'll be 85% invested in equities and I'll bear the ups and the downs. And that's horses. Everyone's got to choose which one's right. We can offer we have some people in the strategic version. most of the people end up with us in the tactical version where we're trying to lean into the cycles, but it's not an absolute return product. Yeah. We're not trying to say, you know, we're going to jump completely out of equities and then jump back in because, well, the other thing that entails is often tax consequences as well. So
capital gains and losses and all those wonderful things, which can really hit you over the head, can't it?
Yeah, and the other thing, actually, I do need to mention as well, we are going to do a conference in October in Melbourne. So as well, so we'll be inviting people in for I'm sure I'll be on before then. I'll give you more details of dates and places and all that type of stuff like that. But yeah, we want to start doing a few live shows now that we're allowed to.
Exactly. Well, that's good. That's good news. And I guess you'll be back on the end of September in roughly a month's time, and we'll see how things have travelled from then. Right?
Yeah. Excellent. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. I'm going to take you off and I'll close the show tonight. See you. So there you go, folks. Hope that you found that useful. And we didn't get all the questions, but hopefully we got a fair few. Just to say that next week, bit of a different show. I'm going to come on and we're going to talk about property and the stress data and look at some of the movements of property. Cookie Boy's been throwing a lot of data in my way and I've got other information too. So mark your diary for that, and I'll have the postcode information online as well. So that'll be next week. So no guests, we're just looking at the data. But that should be fun. And meantime, of course, check in on the other shows during the week. And the doggies, they did move at various points, but they've now gone back to sleep again. So I need to take them out for a last walk of the night. But I'll do that after the show is finished. So thank you for joining us this evening. I hope you found it useful. Please like the show if you haven't done so already. And I will just share with you the poll because, of course, we did ask at the front what the story was. Where will the ASX be in a year's time? So we had 20% saying higher, 47% saying lower, 6% the same, and 27% says it's impossible to tell. So there you go. That would probably sum up quite nicely where where people are. I've put the results in the chat there if people want to look at it afterwards. So some people are saying it's too hard to say. Others thinking it's perhaps more likely on the downside. So there you go. Thank you very much. Have a good evening, and I'll see you next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off. Cheerio.